Turn the page if you dare, today on Podcastmagoria. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Podcastmagoria. My name's Autumn.
And I'm James.
And today we will be discussing some horror magazines of the past and present, because, oh boy, there is a wide umbrella when you're talking about horror magazines.
Yeah, kind of like the genre itself. Mm-hmm. It is just kind of all encapsulating, and some things that squeeze in that I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if we should necessarily put it on this list or not.
But I don't know. Along the way, maybe some honorable mentions.
Yes. You know we love our honorable mentions, folks.
That's right. I'll tell you. So I don't remember there being so many horror magazine options. And it feels like here recently, there is just like a crap ton of physical ones.
A physical, yeah.
Because let's just say I was perusing the shelves and, you know, of course the classics are there. I shan't name, but, there was like a proper section, like a whole, like three row, probably about six magazines wide.
Dang, maybe I should have went with you so I would have knew a little bit more of what to research for the modern day. Because as far as I was aware,
not a whole lot.
Yeah, it went into like online publications, which we'll get into.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like with you know, vinyl and the dreaded cassette, where printed page is starting to kind of come back.
Ooh, I think it's vintage.
Yeah, it's vintage. Maybe they figured out how to do it with like recycled paper or something.
Right, you know, like right.
From the local sewer. Oh. Ooh, this one's scratch and sniff.
I will say sometimes the magazines do smell like that.
Yeah.
Like indie magazines. I always got a kind of sewer smell from some magazines, so maybe that really is it, James.
Yeah, it's that secondhand toilet paper they get from a thrift store.
Oh my god.
Horror magazines, back on track. They have been around for quite some time, you know, and they have definitely helped grow like the popularity of many famous horror and sci-fi writers, inspired directors, and many other corners of the horror community. I mean, like if you listen to an interview with anybody in the horror industry, 9 times out of 10, they'll eventually cycle around and start talking about like some point in time during their teenage years or their youth and their first issue of blankety blank.
Right.
Ooh, I'm just teasing today.
You are. I think people could probably fill in the blanks, though, because I'm sure people know which particular one we will be talking about.
Of course. So, yeah, thanks to the creation of, like, Penny Dreadfuls in the early 1800s and pulp magazines in the later 1800s, the opportunity of the macabre to appear on the page was struck.
why don't you tell us a little bit about those 1800s magazines?
Well, when I was a boy.
Yeah, since you lived it.
Yeah, that's right. Around the 1830s, Penny Dreadfuls were starting to become popular. And, you know, like, it would be crazy not to mention Penny Dreadfuls and stuff like that. Because the fact that that is basically the beginning of this concept.
Plus, I bet a lot of people just think of the television show and don't realize what that name came from.
Right. Yeah. Ooh, you fools. they were just little books, little, you know, cheaply made, cheap little, like for a couple of pennies, essentially you could get, a short story or a continuing like series of stories, that would eventually influence things even today, not only the titular Penny Dreadful TV series, mm-hmm. but also, you know, famous characters were featured in Penny Dreadful, such as a certain fellow named Sweeney Todd. Spring-Heeled Jack, who would, you know, inspire things such as like Batman and others, the Shadow, mm-hmm. lots of other like vigilante types.
And I didn't realize that Spring-Heeled Jack came from Penny Dreadful.
Mm-hmm.
Was he an actual figure too? Because he shows up in like, you know, Unsolved Mystery magazine or Unsolved Mystery books, or, you know, even mm-hmm. cryptozoology books. Yeah. Like he shows up. So what's up with that?
Well, though this episode shan't be dedicated to Mr. Jack, there is some sprigs of truth sprinkled within the Spring-Heeled Jack lore, whatever I was actually, because I did catch myself in a little bit of a rabbit hole when I was reading about Penny Dreadfuls and not just, you know, like, of course, there wasn't just horror characters and stuff, because Robin Hood would, you know, pop up in right. some of them and stuff as well. But
well, yeah. that was dreadful to the rich folk.
That's right. Yeah, not paying their taxes. But yeah, Spring-Heeled Jack, like I started reading about, because I remembered, I think it was an interview with Kevin Conroy,
mm-hmm.
That he, like when he was talking about like Batman and stuff like that, like him kind of thinking about that character, knowing, being aware of that character and stuff, and
right.
and like a lot of other people have like mentioned him over time, and I was just like, oh, this is interesting. And so I started kind of reading a little bit, and I saw that it may or may not be based off a real person that mm-hmm. actually existed, and I don't think he had springs in his shoes, but
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
but there is also a paranormal side of it as well, which is like where he via the stories, I believe it's that he may have been a phantom or some other thing. Like, yeah, it's crazy.
So it's kind of what we've done with Jack the Ripper, essentially, is yeah. like true stories, but we've turned it, we've twisted it into something
yeah.
supernatural and beyond our minds, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It was probably just, you know, some guy that jumped across a rooftop to get away from, you know, the cops.
And they're like, oh my God, I yeah. can't believe how fast he can jump.
That's right. And then from that point on, Spring-Heeled Jack.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a lot of other, you know, characters and stuff. And I don't want to dwell too long on the Penny Dreadful things, just because of the fact that I want to, like, I think each of these categories I would like to expand upon
mm-hmm.
At some point in time, just because of the fact that there are a lot of really fascinating things. And also I feel like, when we eventually talk about the Penny Dreadful TV series,
we'll have to go into the history a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's a, I mean, that show is chock full of all the characters.
Yeah.
And so, so yeah, we'll get to that. A little later on in the 1800s, you would hit a time of the 1890s where publisher Frank Muncy would launch pulp magazines, starting with the influential Argosy magazine.
Brief note.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea that pulp magazines were called pulp magazines because of the material they
yes.
were made of.
Yeah.
I just thought that that was a genre name.
Yeah, it's funny, like, because of pulp being, like, yeah, a genre
yeah.
at this point.
Yeah.
Like, that, yeah, like, going back and reading and learning about pulp magazines and all that kind of stuff, and yeah, like that it's not, it wasn't just a turn of
a
phrase,
silly name
yeah.
for a genre. It's literally because they started making it with wood pulp.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And duty paper.
What the heck? And duty paper, yeah. Yeah.
Like your popular music zines in record shops.
So yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. I'm not sure how many other people out in the world really know that either.
Yeah, right. Like, it feels like one of those things where it's a forehead slapping moment.
Yeah, it should be like that's such yeah. common knowledge.
Yeah, you know, but I don't know.
Maybe... I've been into pulp stuff for like most of my life and
yeah.
never knew that.
Yeah, I love pulp fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this is one of those things where it's going to blur the line a little bit between horror and non-horror, because mm-hmm. Argosy magazine, like, wasn't explicitly a horror magazine to start. It was mostly just short stories. A lot of, like, you know, men's tales of daring men action and mm-hmm. adventurers and stuff like that. And it would kind of like a heavy metal would eventually do, where it started to get a little bit into the more like adult men's magazine, because it right. would be like, you know, busty women being, you know, kidnapped by, you know, a scorpion man, and, you know, and it would describe, you know, her throbbing bosom and, you know,
oh my,
handsome, you know, Phil would come in with his like muscular build and his throbbing thighs.
Oh my.
Is it hot in here? But the thing is that the Argosy would also, you know, start to shift towards sci-fi and other adventurers, and feature a lot of very big names when it comes to literature, like Edgar Wright Burroughs of Tarzan and Space Tarzan fame. Space Tarzan being
John Carter.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. which, this is my forehead slapping moment. I don't know why, because I don't like Tarzan. I don't know why I never was just like, John Carter's Space Tarzan. Yeah. No duds from the same author. It's just Mars instead of jungle of wherever. I don't know. Like, ugh. But also, A. Merritt. Lovecraft's influence. Hey, there we go.
Ah, well.
So through the popularity of Argosy magazine and such, it would end up giving birth to several other classic magazines that would feature, I would say, like a more modern age of horror writers. Firstly being Terror Tales, which featured another person with an initial in their name, E. Hoffman Price. Hey, another Lovecraftian cohort. Imagine that. And then, of course, the extremely popular Weird Tales. Hey! Another asshole with a with an initial for a name. What's his name again?
Well, yes, I think you all know, is H.P. Lovecraft.
That's right. The printer guy.
Well, I have so much to say about Weird Tales, because obviously it's where, like, one of my biggest horror influences came from mm-hmm. and got his start. And it's so funny how a magazine that faced so many troubles over the years of its publication could have launched the careers of so many famous writers like Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, over the years of its publication, Lovecraft would probably be one of the main contributors to the magazine, including ghostwriting a few stories.
Yeah. Ooh, spooky.
which most notably is Harry Houdini, who he ghost for Imprisoned with the Pharaohs is the name of the story that they were like, yes, this is Houdini's writing. Can you believe it? Houdini, the magic man, he can also write. Isn't this crazy?
Wow, he's a man of many hats.
Of course, you know, so Weird Tales is where we saw the birth of Cthulhu. This mm-hmm. is where the Call of Cthulhu came from. We saw the first writings of Robert Bloch of Psycho fame. Mm-hmm. And this is probably also where people first heard the phrase of necrophilia.
Hey!
Which, that's what got the magazine banned in a lot of places, according to rumor. The first editor of Weird Tales, though, is probably why the magazine had a rocky start, because the guy didn't like horror.
Oh!
He was more into, like, detective tales and stuff like that. But for some reason wanted to start up a horror publication, I don't know, and he had like really specific writer guidelines. Like he wanted everything submitted in double spaced, you know. And H.P. Lovecraft absolutely hated typing, but he resubmitted his stories with the double spaced typing every time. So the initial run of Weird Tales ended up stopping around 1954. It would come back in 1973, go all the way till 1988, and then come back under another name of Worlds of Fantasy and Horror. eventually coming back to Weird Tales in 1998.
Yeah.
So it's just had such a rocky, like, publication.
Yeah. I find that that's a theme with a lot of the horror magazines that people definitely know the name of, you know, mm-hmm. and we'll be getting to those, of course, here in a bit. But yeah, like, it's so, and I don't know if it's just that, you know, a lot of sci-fi and horror writers are mildly cantankerous.
Yes, yes.
The community of authors in those genres are probably some of the most, like, unfriendly, just hate the business, hate writing,
yeah,
hate fans.
Well, a lot of the people involved in Weird Tales were especially like that.
Yeah.
I mean, Lovecraft being the main, like, main guy.
Yeah. And then what later on, Harlan Ellison would contribute.
Yeah, I believe Harlan Ellison, I might be wrong about that. It might have been a different publication, but I feel like he had stuff in Weird Tales.
He hated Weird Tales, and it is like rolling in his grave, going, how dare they attach my name to Weird Tales.
But I mean, even down to the editor of the magazine being so, like, specific about everything that he wanted for this magazine. And he even admitted he would just buy stuff just to reject it.
Yeah, that's so crazy to me.
Yeah. Like, the second editor was a little more lenient, mm-hmm. But he's the one that kind of crashed the magazine into the ground. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Right. Well, I'll tell you what I would do. I would start up a fan magazine for the fans of horror. And I would call that magazine Fantasy Fan. How original. This is, of course, it started in 1935. It's one of the first fan magazines, especially when it comes to horror and sci-fi and the like. This is where, like, another huge grouping of legends would band together and write horror stories. I think, honestly, anybody that had their fill or just was pissed off with Weird Tales
mm-hmm.
went to Fantasy Fans and was just like, yeah, this is where I'm gonna go.
Yeah,
unfortunately, since it's a fan run magazine, it didn't last very long.
Yeah. I was gonna say that one didn't last too long.
It was like 2 years or something like that. It was a shame. I had a shit ton of, like, anybody that was of that time, wrote for it.
Well, it's probably because Weird Tales already had such a big name that people were still just like, well, I know this magazine, so why would I?
Oh, yeah.
Why would I read something that is written by the fans of the magazine that I love?
Exactly. Well, these amateurs.
Yeah.
Not taking the time to realize that those quote-unquote amateurs were Lovecraft and all these other people,
right?
But I think, honestly, a big part of it is the fact that Fantasy Fan, if you look at the cover of the first issue, it is about as dry and drab as possible because there's no picture, it's just text. And you gotta think, like, one of the biggest things that, like, the draw to pulp magazines is the amazing art that's on the cover of every single one of them.
I mean, look at any cover of Weird Tales and you're just like, whoa, what the heck is that thing, you know?
Yeah, like the amount of imagination that the artists would present for Weird Tales. But yeah, like, a lot of, like, really big names in fantasy art and stuff would contribute to the cover of it. And it, like, I mean, I dare you, like, I'll tell you, if you go and look at just, like, a collage of covers for Weird Tales, it's hard not to go, well, I want a poster of that one, I want a poster of that one, because they're just all awesome. And very rarely do any of the covers reflect what actually is inside the magazine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No.
To get into what I like to call the golden age of horror magazines, we might as well start with the famous one, and that being Famous Monsters of Filmland, 1958. Hey-o. Quite honestly, I feel that if this magazine hadn't been created, then most of the rest of this episode would be very short. Because Famous Monsters would set the bar as far as what all future horror enthusiasts and horror film magazines would then emulate. Taking magazines past just Tales of Terror, this would be a collection of everything that horror movie fans would want out of a magazine. So it's not just a collection of stories. It's not just a comic book, mm-hmm. you know, quote, magazine. This is everything that you want out of horror film, mm-hmm. Which is enormous. And, you know, the covers for it, again, is one of those things that I find is a huge draw. This magazine would be in the hands of all the little ghoulies that would eventually grow up to be big time famous monsters themselves.
Yes. Elvira mentions this magazine specifically in her book, as she had gotten all these like little horror icon models from the catalog in the back of the book.
Yeah.
So she said that while her sisters were playing with Barbie and Midge, she was making all sorts of like just all these horror movies up in her head with her little figurines.
Cool.
So I'm like, oh, that's so cute. So I was really happy that you included this one on the list.
Oh,
because obviously very influential.
Oh, incredibly. Yeah. And I mean, so much so that it even became the album title for the horror punk band The Misfits. Second iteration. Danzig Free. It was just huge. And I mean, of course, the covers would have all the, you know, horror icons, not mm-hmm. just like Frankenstein, Mummy, Wolfman, stuff like that, but horror hosts as well. Like Zachary Lee, like when you see any of like the promo stuff for Zachary Lee, like in the fan club and all that kind of stuff, of that, like, you know, like the painting version of his ghoulish face.
Yeah.
That's the famous monsters picture.
Well, I think that artist is the one that did the art for the genealogy tree in a Monster Club.
I believe that is correct also. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just like,
because I mean, it's iconic style.
Exactly. So. Yeah. You know, famous monsters would be scaring kids in the magazine aisle of grocery stores across America. Obviously, this one's iconic enough to probably get its own episode, especially since it's had kind of like a few, kind of like Weird Tales, it's kind of had its ups and downs over the years mm-hmm, as well, mm-hmm. going in and out of print, and here recently returning, and is about to get a revitalization in the coming year.
Oh,
a huge deal. There's a lot of coming soon buttons on the website.
Nice.
This was also one of the first horror magazines that I owned.
Ooh. Well, not me.
Another one that I felt was worthy of mentioning would be Monster Times, that came out in 1972. They say that imitation is the greatest sign of flattery, and this magazine sure flattered famous monsters. It was flat out made to be direct competition of famous monsters. Mm,
so it wasn't a fan magazine.
No, it was not a fan of a fan magazine, that's right. You know, the thing that made this one a little bit more neat is the fact that with each issue, the reader's blood would run cold, for monsters were the centerfold.
Oh, my gosh. But that's awesome. I wish I had one of those.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it was just like a little illustrated poster of.
Yeah,
like,
I believe so. Yeah.
Like the creature from the Black Lagoon, all laying Burt Reynolds style.
Yeah, that's right. With a can of sardines in front of his.
I'm just imagining that for my own good. Is what there you it go. Is.
Unfortunately, this magazine did not last very long, even with that gimmick. I believe it went under in 74 or so.
Oh, wow. So only a couple of years for
only
it,
only a couple
too.
Of years as well. Like, I mean, kind of like with Weird Tales versus Fantasy Fan, I feel that it was a, why would I buy a knockoff when I have this one?
This goes to show, too, that, you know, people are always going, oh, magazines don't last these days. Blah. Magazines of olden times lasted forever. And it's like, well, no, they didn't really nobody was paying attention to them.
Yeah, with the like exception of like, you know, dirty magazines, like,
yeah.
Which seem to last forever.
Well, there's always a market for that.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Horror magazines and a lot of other like fan-based ones, sci-fi and all that, specific genre magazines. Yeah. They traded hands left and right, changed names because like a lot of the, especially the older ones, like the pulp magazines and stuff, they changed names all the freaking time.
Yeah. Yeah. It was hard to keep up with a couple of the pulp magazines that I was trying to do research on. I was just like, oh my gosh, how did anybody keep up with this?
Yeah, there was a few that I was just like, well, these details will bog down the episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of the ashes comes another, however, after Monster Times had gone down as a competitor for Famous Monsters. In 1979, the legendary Fangoria would hit the shelves.
Woo!
I mean, I don't think that there's anybody in the horror community that doesn't know
what
Fangoria is.
This was my first horror magazine.
This was my second.
Obviously.
This was the reason why I was, like, Fangoria was the reason why I wasn't allowed to get horror magazines.
Because they would show, like, all the gruesome stuff from the movies.
I remember being so excited. I couldn't tell you what the cover of the issue was. Mm-hmm. But I remember begging to get it at the grocery store. Going, oh my God, it's got so-and-so on the cover. This is going to be great. And I have to see it. And all that. My parents were like, I don't know. And they're like, all right, cool. Because Mom, of course, probably wanted it also.
Yeah.
And so I remember taking it home. And I was like, 5. Oh. Taking it home, running upstairs, going into closing my bedroom door, flipping open the pages. The first thing was like some horrifying mutilated corpse or something. And I went, ack! And I threw it immediately into my little trash can.
You know, I think Fangoria, the pictures that they have of like the gore and stuff from the movies, somehow it looks worse than it does in the movies.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because I remember, I can't remember which movie it is, but it was pretty much a person with all their guts displayed on a table just laying there, eh. And it looked so much more gruesome in Fangoria than it actually did in the movie.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I hated it. It was the promo picture for the magazine for the longest time. It's like the terrifying, in my opinion, scene from Total Recall whenever the helmet, you know, his helmet breaks and his eyes are bugging out. That was like the promo picture.
I remember it.
Every time there was a commercial or a magazine advertising Fangoria, that was the picture.
It was the like the website banner like advertisement for a long time.
Yeah. Jump scare.
For real.
Every time.
I think though that my first issue of Fangoria that I ever read was the Pumpkinhead one.
Oh. Okay.
Because I very specifically remember him being on the cover and me going, oh, look at that little guy. Look at him.
Yeah.
It started early for me, folks, with the look how cute that little monster is.
Yeah. I wish that I still had that issue, I think, whatever issue it was I had as a kid. I have no idea what happened to it. I'm very certain that it didn't just get thrown out. You know, like I think my mom hid it away or whatever.
Yeah.
And time took it away. But less about us and our experience.
Yeah, let's not go into our nostalgia. What is Fangoria, James? Like, what is it about? Why is it so influential to us and other people in the horror community?
Obviously, this is arguably one of the biggest horror movie magazines to still chill enthusiasts today. It is a collection of interviews, previews, reviews, and some things you can't unview.
That's for sure.
It was such a big deal because the fact that up until this moment, there wasn't, I mean, like, you know, Famous Monsters was around and it did a great job with like, you know, giving you a little bit of insight for like, you know, the horror films and stuff like that. But Fangoria, it was like, from the mind of a extreme horror fan, this was what you wanted. Because every article was exactly what you wanted to know about the littlest weird details for horror films or TV shows. And they had all the previews for stuff that was coming up. And I mean, shit, you would get to see behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, I always loved seeing like the special effects, like them putting the makeup on the actors or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was awesome. I mean, like, yeah, like I have since my first experience with it, I have since like gotten my hands on a few, like they weren't ever mine. They were always someone else's. There was a tattoo parlor that I hung out in long ago that had a bunch of issues. So I'd sit there and read it.
Nice.
But yeah, like it was great because you get to see like any of the ones that had, you know, that featured Hellraiser. You got to get, like, the in-depth detail of each Cenobite that was featured in that film.
Didn't they have, like, advertisements for, or, well, I don't know if this is a false memory or not, but I feel like they had advertisements for, like, Tom Savini's, like, special effects school and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think that was the other thing is the fact that it felt like you almost had an in.
Yeah.
You know, to it. Because there would be contact information for horror schools, special effects schools, and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, and then over time, like, there would be little things that I think that it was like the secret password to getting into the industry. Mm-hmm. Where if you could go Fangoria issue 178, The Chiller, and they go, right this way, sir. You know, something like that, like where it's just like somehow that was the thing. And if you look at any production photos from any horror movies made from 1979 on, there's always somebody in the special effects team that has a Fangoria shirt.
Yep.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, skateboarders with Thrasher, like Fangoria is just like that, you know, wink, wink, shake your, you know, like your foot three times, you get to go inside the club.
Yeah, it would be so weird to talk to another horror enthusiast and they didn't know the name Fangoria.
Oh, for sure. So, I mean, like, that pretty much, you know, I could spend all day talking about Fangoria, but we've got others to get to.
Yeah, because, I mean, during this time, it seemed like magazines were trying to be more picture-esque, like showing us stuff rather than telling us about stuff. So I feel like during this time period, a lot of magazines kind of went away from the user-submitted stories. Magazines were definitely hitting a new era. But in 1988, we had another magazine try to come back with those tales of horror. And a lot of people probably know this magazine and, well, let me just get into it. Cemetery Dance.
Oh, God.
What? You don't like Cemetery Dance?
Oh, no, I like, it's giving me a brain freeze because I'm trying, like, because it,
well,
sing me a few more lines of the song. I think I'll know it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so. Let me take you back.
Okay.
This magazine did start out with very humble beginnings, as it was started by a then college student named Richard Schismar, is how I'm going to assume the last name is pronounced.
Sure.
But Richard went into this project knowing that he had a love of horror. He had a set of guidelines that he wanted the writers submitting stories to follow. So he had a formula down. And he also bought out all this ad space for this magazine. Like, he was serious about like his love of horror and wanting to get more stories out. So by the time the first issue came out, they had only printed about 1,000 copies, a little over half sold.
Oh.
Which for a first magazine with such a small print, that's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. I mean, it's, you know, half.
Yeah, started by a college student. I would be thrilled.
Yeah.
By the fifth issue, though, they straight up had it down. Like, the covers were full color. Everything just looked professional by then. So, you know, not in the business very long.
But had a plan.
But had a plan. And that's why this magazine just kept growing and growing. Mm-hmm. And by the 14th issue, we had some big name submitting stories. One such name being Stephen King.
Hey-o.
The first story that he decided to submit to this magazine because he loved it so much. He's like, hey, I think this story would probably fit into your magazine really well. And you'll never guess what story that was, James.
Pet Sematary?
Nope. Oh. Chattering Teeth.
Oh, my God.
That we know very well from Quicksilver Highway.
Oh, my God.
So how that's topical. So,
that's crazy.
Yeah. When I saw that, I was like, oh, my God. I can't believe that's where the Chattering Teeth story came from.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So eventually Stephen King would become a regular contributor to this magazine, even like doing a co-writing with Richard himself on some
nuts.
Stories for the magazine.
Could you imagine?
I know, Stephen King was so big at the time, and this is a young dude just right out of college. And you have, like, one of the biggest horror writers wanting to write for your magazine and with you.
Yeah, that's a huge deal.
Amazing.
I think that's, that's the difference between, like, I would say mildly modern horror writers, fans, and whatnot, mm-hmm. versus the olden days.
Yeah.
Because by this point, the business is basically run by fans.
Yeah.
People, Stephen King's mm-hmm. a fan.
Yeah.
John Carpenter, huge fan.
Right.
And so it's a little easier. Some of them are still kind of cantankerous, but you just put a bucket of blood in front of them and they chill out a little bit.
Right. I will say, though, that this magazine is probably one of the more longer-running magazines, as I think the last issue that I saw did come out in 2019, but it is one of those publications that, sporadically puts out magazines. But they are a full-on book publishing company now, too.
Whoa.
Cemetery Dance is a very big name in the horror magazine community because of how influential it actually was. But, I had totally forgotten about it until doing research for this list.
Yeah, that's the thing is, I feel like I've been in the same room as it, but I...
Yeah. Because, I think even, Poppy Z. Bright even put in stories to this magazine and stuff like that, so... there's a lot of influence there.
Yeah. Wow. Look at them.
So, yeah.
Well, I guess moving on into the more modern age.
Because we're starting to get there.
Yeah, we're warming up. Let's jump into the 90s to 1997, a more modern magazine that's still in print. Hey.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Rue Morgue.
Yeah.
Which I remember seeing this on the shelves, mm-hmm. Next to Fangoria and such. And I remember also turning my nose up at it.
I remember being like the people of the past and going, I already read Fangoria. Why do I need to read another one?
Yeah. And the thing is that for the longest time, most of the grocery stores I went to in my little towns in Missouri, if there was a horror magazine, 9 times out of 10, it was Fangoria.
Right.
Every so often. And it was very, very rare. But Rue Morgue would show up and it would normally be stuck between the Bigfoot magazine and the UFO magazine. It wouldn't even be over in the film trades with Fangoria and stuff. And so you had to go over to the between the Farmer's Almanac and the Civil War enthusiasts, section.
Right.
That's where they stuck it.
Right.
So I'm honestly, and I don't know how it was in the rest of the country, but at least in Missouri, that's how it was. And so that's what makes me a little surprised at how big a deal this magazine actually became and was.
I was really lucky because I think by the time Rue Morgue was in its second or third year of publication, we had gotten a Books a Million.
Oh.
Yeah. So I got to see it firsthand right by Fangoria and going, at it.
Yeah, fair enough. I really hate the fact that I slept on this one.
Me too.
Because the fact that if you are an enthusiast of horror all over, just not just movies, and you want to read about behind the scenes, hey, Fangoria, thank you for your service, but sometimes I need a little bit more than just, you know, what Tom Savini's up to.
Yeah.
And that's where Rue Morgue comes in, because they would cover everything.
Yeah, even going back to publish short stories.
Yeah. Like it was what I like to call the Whitman sampler of horror magazines, because it would feature bands, it would feature comics, it would feature movies, stories, like you said, anything, clothing mm-hmm. lines, like
it, yeah, because like, it had like the little goth snippets in it
was the whole, I think it encapsulates the culture of horror.
Yes.
And that's what makes me so mad that I didn't pick up magazines.
Same. Yeah, Fangoria is all about the media. Mm-hmm. Rue Morgue is about the culture.
Yeah. This was the, you know, it was the guideline of what you needed to do if you wanted to eat, sleep, breathe horror.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're dedicating your life to the darkness, this is the magazine you need to have in your hands, because any other of them, they don't give you enough of the complete picture.
Plus, it's another magazine that always has pretty cool covers.
Oh my God. Yeah. And that's the thing, is like, it would always, I'd look at it and go, I see you, Rue Morgue, but mm-hmm. I'm still going to turn my nose up to you.
But then I'd see, you know, Jeepers Creepers on the other cover and be like, oh, look at your Jeepers Creepers.
Get out of my brain, because that was exactly what I was thinking. It's like, because I think like the issues next to each other was like Amy Lee from Evanescence uh-huh. on Rue Morgue.
Yeah.
And then Jeepers Creepers on Fangoria. I don't know. And so, yeah, like I guess I just didn't know what to expect with it.
Yeah.
Had I just picked up one issue.
Right.
I would have been like, oh, well, this is for me. This is what I need.
Right. You know?
To jump a little bit further in time and kind of like get into the abstract that horror magazines have, the age that we're in now of horror magazines, I wanted to mention a newer one, and that is Lunch Meat VHS.
Mm-hmm.
Started in 2008. This is, you know, they say that there's nothing wrong with dabbling with the super specific. And if you're really into horror movies that were featured on VHS and VHS only, this is the one for you. I only just learned about Lunch Meat in doing the research for this episode.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of it.
And I almost didn't include them because of the fact that it is flat out just VHS enthusiasts renovating, preserving, and just loving that culture that has come back in a big way here recently. And but I'll tell you, I'm a little jealous of their promotional pictures for their horror movies, because they are so incredibly fun, because it'll be like the featured VHS horror movie.
Uh-huh.
And then like the set like that they do for that VHS will have things in it that are related to the movie. You know, kind of like we do for our promotional pictures.
Yeah,
but it's just, cute. You just get rid of two, you know, ding dongs and replace it with a VHS.
Uh-huh.
And but it was just so fun. And if anybody were to do anything after listening to this episode, I recommend popping over to Lunch Me VHS just to check out the VHS stuff, because it was really fun. They've got a ton of merch over there and by the way, not sponsored, but they've got a lot of fun stuff that, like, if you miss the old days of getting a little jump scare walking through the horror section of your Blockbuster or Pop and Go Video, they capture that side of horror nostalgia very well. And and I think that they're definitely worth checking out, you know, especially because of the fact that they are doing really good work with collecting and preserving horror movies and exploitation films and stuff like that. That, I mean, if it wasn't for these enthusiasts and people uploading stuff to archive.org, lost to time. Because VHSs are dying out real fast.
Oh,
we're,
yeah.
We're hitting basically VHS Armageddon.
Yeah.
Where all the tapes, no matter how well you preserve them, they're erased.
And it's so funny because Gen Z is really into
VHS. Well, the ding dong, the expiration date's coming up. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Because like, the tapes are it's almost like we put movies on bread. You know what I mean? Like it's a very organic material.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to last, and it's all dissolving.
Like, so sad. Just when it's coming back in style again.
That's insane. But yeah, a lot of people that have VHS collections, like, you know, just sitting in a cabinet in their home, hadn't touched it in 30 years. Now that VHS are coming back in, they're digging out their VCRs and discovering that a lot of the tapes are blank. Yeah, so, you know, with Lunch Meet VHS, I think it's a good segue to kind of get to the Beyond the Page section of the episode.
Essentially honorable mentions.
Honorable mentions. Yeah, well, because the fact that a lot of this is, these are, you know, online magazines, which I feel is a weird title to get. Like, it's a blog.
Yeah, isn't essentially.
It? It's an enthusiast website. It's weird.
It's an archive.
Sure. Like,
because one of the ones that I specifically would like to mention, Dark Realms, is kind of an archive of short horror stories. Mm-hmm. All the issues ever sold out, though. All the online issues are sold out.
That's so crazy.
How does that happen?
How does a digital media become sold out? That seems impossible.
Yeah.
I guess server space.
I guess. I don't know. But
that doesn't make sense.
Are to make it more desirable.
Right.
Ooh, yeah, I need that file.
I gotta get that file.
I gotta get that file of that magazine.
I wonder if old archive.org. Yeah, it is definitely worth mentioning, though, that the horror magazines aren't strictly printed on paper these days. And even though I'm being a grumpy grandpa about it, you know, back in the 90s, fans started making their own websites dedicated to the creepy, you know. And I mean, like, a lot of people probably thought it was ridiculous. I sure as hell did. The concept of an online magazine.
Yeah, I thought that it was pretty silly.
Yeah.
Just because I liked going to the store and picking up and actually holding the pictures in my hands, you know?
Yeah, like, it's just one of those things that, but, you know, a lot of magazines have since switched over to being strictly online.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, like, look, Cracked.
Cracked. A fine gentleman's magazine.
For the gentleman's mad magazine. I clicked it Cracked, and now it's just a website.
Yeah.
You know, and is barely like reflective of its past.
I can only imagine that it's mostly memes.
Pretty much. It lists the memes. It's basically what BuzzFeed would eventually be.
Yeah.
Cracked.com.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah, flooding our Facebook feeds every day.
Yeah.
But yeah, like a lot of Famous Monsters during its hiatus, many hiatuses, became an online only. Mm-hmm. Fangoria started to do online only publications.
Yeah.
A lot of horror magazines. And I mean, let's face it, it was out of style, like physical paper and stuff like that, because of waste and not having a good way to like manage it. And obviously, like, a lot of magazines after the first week of having it, it just goes either in the trash or in a box and it just fills up space.
Yeah.
Next thing you know, you have the horror equivalent of your great Aunt Edna and all of her old phone books.
Right. Well, and plus, like, with Fangoria being an example, if you have an online publication like that, then you can also include other media such as videos. And it's so much easier to show you what Tom Savini's doing than talk about it.
That's right. Well, also, I mean, the thing is like when it comes to publicating when it comes to publishing a magazine, that takes time.
Yeah.
You know, and so unless you are really good friends with every single person in the industry and stuff, it's impossible to keep up with right. what's going on. And so you either have to work really hard at finding, you get a crystal ball and know what's coming out in the next couple of months, or you only cater to things of the past, mm-hmm. you know, or like Rue Morgue, if you do a little bit of everything, then you're perfectly safe.
Right.
You know, but yeah, a lot of the horror film enthusiast magazines and stuff had to be online because there was no way in hell to keep up with all these other fan websites
mm-hmm.
because they were definitely getting out ahead of their stories months in advance. Another one, and speaking of short story collecting websites and stuff, one that I really started to dig into, and I plan on exploring a hell of a lot more after you know, after this episode and such, and that is the Horror Zine website, which is they are kind of like the digital age equivalent of Fantasy Fan, because mm-hmm. they accept writers, like, you know, amateur writers or whomever, you know, to submit things, and anything that you like horror, basically, you can submit to them, and they will, if not collect it, because they're a huge archive also, if they don't end up collecting it, they also will connect you to people that maybe you want to be involved with. Like, so it's a
that's
it's
pretty
not,
cool.
Yeah, it's not a bad like jumping off point.
Yeah, it's a stepping stone yeah. for people. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I you know, granted, the website looks like it's from 1999.
Well, it probably is.
Yeah. But it is very straight to the point. There are a million links on every single page to other pages. It's a lot. It's mm-hmm. a lot to soak in. I didn't have enough time in preparation of this episode to get my hands completely around the Horror Zine. But I think I found a thing that's going to take up a lot of my spare time looking into.
I think the honorable mention that I kind of want to talk about,
mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to briefly mention this because they were kind of influential to me as a young horror enthusiast, and kind of what helped me develop a lot of my style choices are goth magazines.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like they're kind of softly in this category.
Yeah.
You know, of course, publications like Gothic Beauty mm-hmm. and Propaganda, you know, they would occasionally have little articles about horror things sure. that were happening in the community. So, you know, since we kind of mentioned it with Rue Morgue, I just kind of wanted to push that out there and be yeah. like, go back and look at some of these goth magazines too, folks.
Yeah. Well, you know, another horror enthusiast website that that was incredibly influential to me and you know, was a jumping off point for a lot of other websites, of course, was The Cabinet of Dr. Kilgari.
Oh, yeah.
That, I mean, it had links to, you know, not just the websites for, you know, publications, but all the horror stuff. And it had yeah. a lot of horror news on it, too.
Yeah.
And that was my go-to in the early days of the internet. Like, if I wanted to find anything new or mm-hmm. just, you know, listen to a bunch of horrible MIDI covers of horror themes.
or goth songs.
Goth songs. Or if I wanted to look at a page of horror themed GIFs that would freeze my computer every time, that
right,
was the website.
Right.
You know. So that was, you know, and I guess that's a good way to kind of, and you know, wrap it up.
Yeah.
Because there are so many other, when you talk about, you know, horror zines online, it is an endless list, because anybody that's got an internet connection and access to a web browsing or a website builder app can make, you know, essentially an online zine.
Yeah.
So my question to our listeners is this: what other horror magazines have you read?
Yeah, because I know that there are some that we did not mention.
Oh, God. Well, Shudder is one.
Because I know I could have went into a lot more of the history of Terror Tales. I just was so excited to get to Weird Tales.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and the thing is that there are a lot of horror, quote, magazines, unquote, that I don't really want to include because of the fact that though they're a magazine, they're comics. It's a comic collection, you know, so.
Yeah, because like Eerie.
Mm-hmm, creepy.
There was one we came across, Maggot.
Yeah. Yeah, that one was really fun. But yeah. But yeah, it's just it's a collection of short horror stories in graphic, you know, form.
Yeah.
And
each like, with their own little narrator character. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. So when we eventually get around to that very specific thing,
mm-hmm.
You know, I look forward to talking about those because a lot of them feature artists that were incredibly influential for way different things.
Yes.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Podcast Magoria. Our next episode gets us into that wintry season, folks. That's right. The holidays are upon us.
Yep. And what better way to celebrate the holidays than with a Christmas movie?
There we go. Yeah. That movie being Silent Night, Deadly Night.
A classic. Yeah. And of course, we had to get to it eventually because I didn't realize there was like 5 or 6 films in this series. I thought that there were only 2 of these movies.
Yeah.
But my God, there's so many of them. So
yeah.
We have a few years in us.
That's right. Yep. Things might get a little wobbly in the next couple of weeks because of the fact that usually like this time of year we do, you know, of course, a movie review. We do a little scary story. And then we also do like, you know, maybe a nostalgia thing and traditions and all that. This is going to be a little different this year, folks, because of the fact that we are also going to be attending another convention.
Oh.
Hey-o. That's right. I'm doing a plug. We are going to be attending Geekmas over in the Springfield, Missouri Expo Center, December 2nd, 3rd, and 4th.
Yep, we will be doing a few little panels.
Yeah.
Got a live recording happening.
Yeah, ooh, our first. Yeah, so if you're in the area and you're listening to this before it happens.
Which is this next week,
yeah,
I think.
This is coming week. Yeah, definitely come out and say hi and you know, see what scary things we bring to the table. Until next time, when you are staying up past your bedtime to read something a little spooky, be sure to throw the covers over your head, keep plenty of batteries nearby for your flashlight, and most importantly, you must stay spooky.
Brains. Brains.
Bye.
You've been listening to Podcast Magoria with Autumn and James, starring Autumn Campbell and James Davis, produced by Taryn Westphal, with music by James Davis. Like what you heard? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to follow on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for posts related to Podcast Magoria Productions. And as always, stay spooky.
Heheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheheh